So, this is the podcast on Najib Mahfouz's Zabalawi, that short story that we've read kind of at the tail end of this existentialism little module here. So, if you take a look at the biographical stuff from Mahfouz, you see that you know, he basically was a civil servant for his entire working life, and wrote on the side, really popular in he wrote screenplays. I think over 30 of them have been produced as movies. And he wrote incredibly significant novels. He's known as the kind of the godfather, or the grandfather, actually, of modern Arabic fiction. So someone like Al-Aswani in the Yacobean building would certainly be a direct kind of literary descendant of someone like Mahfouz. As he grows up, he's living through kind of this traditional Egyptian society, coming to terms with Western influences, with modernity. And you'll see that throughout his biographical information. This is really kind of where he's looking at in terms of and it's really kind of his preoccupation in most of his works. Beyond the works that beyond Zabalawi, I'd like to draw your attention to this book, Children of Gabalawi, published in 1959, or sometimes known as Children of the Alley, depending upon the translation. He tries to tell the story of the foundation of the three great Western monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But he does it through analogy or allegory by talking about the creation of three different neighborhoods around a central garden, a central palace where this supposedly divine being lives. This text gets, when it's published, he has a fatwa issued against him, and you'll see that. A fatwa literally just means any religious teaching. Go to church on Sunday, right? That's a fatwa, technically. Or you know, go to the mosque on Fridays, pray five times a day, right? Those are all fatwas. But in the West, our understanding of a fatwa means literally like a death sentence, kind of a hit order against somebody. Some religious leader in Egypt in 1959 decided that this text, Children of Gabalawi, was offensive to Islam, and so issued a fatwa, basically saying it's incumbent upon any good-believing Muslim that if you meet Najib Mahfouz, to kill him, basically, you know, because of the way he's talked about Islam. Well, Mahfouz doesn't really pay this much mind, and from 1959, while he's still writing all the time, and in 1988, he wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. The year after that, another famous writer, Salman Rushdie, has a fatwa issued against him. Now, for almost 30 years, well, actually, in fact, probably maybe a little bit more than 30 years, Mahfouz has had this fatwa issued against him, but nobody's ever done anything. And he doesn't change his life, lived in the same place in Cairo, walked to work every day, these different jobs. I think he ends up basically working at the library there for a while, the National Library. And in 1989, he supports Salman Rushdie, who has a fatwa issued against him for a text he wrote. And somebody remembers, oh, don't we have like a really outstanding fatwa, like a kind of an outstanding warrant against this guy? Salman Rushdie goes into hiding for 3 years, and even now, when he travels, has members of the kind of the British Secret Service as bodyguards for him. Mahfouz has nothing like that, right? And so in kind of in 1994, right, 5 years after this second fatwa is issued against him, two Islamic fundamentalists attack him with a screwdriver on his walk to work, stab him in the neck, and he fends them off and survives it, right? And goes on, lives for another 12 years, and dies in this kind of ironic twist that he falls outside of his apartment on his way, I think, just to the market, hits his head and dies that way. So for a guy who's literally survived attack by terrorists, it's kind of an ironic way for him to die. But as you see in Zabalawi, he takes religion very seriously. The other links that you should probably look at, that first link on Islamic calligraphy gives you plenty of examples. But what's really important down there at the very bottom is the arc of the narrator's journey in Zabalawi. Right. And the people he meets as he's looking for Zabalawi, the six different people, and the distinctions between them, right, the person, occupation, setting, and then some notes on each one of them, and why there's a break in the middle of them, which is an explanation there. And then I want to talk about disponibility and the mystical experience, because that's what really our narrator is looking for, and that's what he eventually has. We're going to pay really particular attention to that drunk scene at the end of Zabalawi to see what that mystical experience is like. Right? The definition is there, you've seen, and if you remember the mysticism page from when we looked at Candide, which is also on the teaching site, we talked about the whirling dervishes and what a basic definition of mysticism as the direct, unmediated experience of the divine. Then mysticism in Hinduism and in Christianity, right, on that mysticism page. But if you're going back to that that thing, and if you click on the image there of that table and then the explanations underneath it, it'll bring up PDFs that you can download, or you can look at, or you can magnify, right? So with these six people that he meets as he's looking for Zabalawi, right? We get a real movement from Western kind of ideals to a far more traditional pre-modern sense of ideals, right? But let's ask first, who or what is Zabalawi? Is he a saint, right? Is he a mystic? Is he a holy man? Or is he an embodiment of the divine? And the answer for that is yes. He's all of those things, right? He's this kind of amorphous religious figure. And the reason why our narrator is looking for him is because he wants a cure. A cure for what? Well, he says, I have the disease which has no cure. Well, you know, there's only one disease that has no cure. And that's the thing we're all going to die of. Oh, yes, you know, I might die from Parkinson's, or I might die from congestive heart failure, or someone might die because they get hit by a truck or whatever, right? Those are all just particulars. The one disease that we all have that's going to kill us all is life, right? Because inevitably, this is what happens. You can't die unless you've lived. Our man, our narrator, who goes unnamed in this text, who goes, is looking for a sense of meaning, looking for a way to understand his life, looking for a way to make it all make sense, just like the existentialists would do. And he chooses, our narrator here, chooses religion, but he chooses it willingly. Right, so it's not thrust upon him or anything like that. And so he's going looking for Zabalawi because he thinks Zabalawi can help him understand this, help him with a cure for the meaninglessness of his existence. He starts with our lawyer, who is dressed in Western garb at the Chamber of Commerce building and isn't really interested in helping the narrator because he realizes he can't make money off this guy. Right? This is Sheikh Kamar. And Sheikh, by the way, is not somebody's name. It's just an honorific. It's like saying Mr. or Sir or Your Eminence or something like that. So that's our first guy. And it's been a long time, decades, since he's seen Zabalawi. And he gets the next person we go to is the bookseller. Where he's got that little joke that is probably not really funny. Maybe it's more funny in the Arabic, right? He calls him it's a guy who sells books, and he calls him a mere prologue to a man. A prologue is a little short section that begins a book, right? So he's playing with the idea that this guy sells it. You know, nobody laughs at that joke. But he sells books on theology and mysticism. Nevertheless, he sells books. And then the third guy, we don't even get his name, but he's an unnamed sheikh. He's a politician. And I think I say that, I say in the image that he's a typical politician. Why? Because he's telling the narrator something the narrator already knows, and he's acting like he's doing him a really great favor, right? He's absolutely no help at all, but he really thinks he is. Because what he tells the narrator is, well, listen, I don't know where he is, but here, take one of these maps and, you know, break it into quarters and do like a grid thing. Look for him in one place, and if he's not there, go to another section of the grid. Well, you know, that's kind of a no-brainer because, you know, think about when you lose your keys. Well, I've lost my keys. I need to keep checking the cushions of the couch. Yes, they must keep on. No, you've checked the cushions of the couch. They're not there. You're going to look somewhere else. This is not brain surgery here. This is the way we do things, right? But the politician acts as if he's done, he's given the narrator some blinding revelation about this, when in actuality, he's done nothing except tell the narrator what the narrator already knows. And then in terms of kind of who these characters are, we have a break. We have a serious break. Because look at the occupations of the next three guys. Calligrapher, a composer slash musician, and a man of private means. Right? There's something fundamentally different between a lawyer, a businessman, and a politician, and an artist, a musician, and a guy who's just kind of independently wealthy. Right? What's the difference? Well, those first three, lawyer, businessman, politician, they're all things that we think are really important, but they're all things that are bound by humans. Laws change. Lawyers keep up with it. Right? Supply and demand changes the notion of commerce. And politicians, we vote them in and out of office all the time, things like that. Now, we respect all these people and we think they're important, but what they're really responsible for is human stuff. Stuff that is all about the body politic, how we interact with one another. These next three guys, they're not really about how we interact with one another. The calligrapher, well, if you take a look at the page on Islamic calligraphy, you see that in Islam, in most denominations within Islam, you don't represent the human figure. So what we get is lots of ornate writing, usually writing surahs or specific verses from a surah from the Quran, right? And you've got plenty of examples of that in terms of, you know, here's what, the Lion of Judah looks like, or the Horse Surah, or the Divine Support with the Wave of Kanagawa, or Tawhid. You have plenty of these examples, right, of how they're able to manipulate this text to make it look ornate, make it look like a work of art. And so the question becomes, because the next guy we're going to see is a musician who's also producing works of art, the question becomes, why is this piece of calligraphy, this piece of graphic art, somehow lower down on the scale than the piece of music? And here's the reason why. If I buy one of these calligraphic things, and I hang it on the wall, 15 years from now, barring, you know, an earthquake or something, that's still going to be hanging on my wall. Right? It exists. Now, it didn't exist at a time in the past. Then the artist created it. And it exists from now into the future. And, you know, if it's done well enough and nothing terrible happens to it, it can exist for hundreds of years into the future. Not so with music. Because let's get really technical here about what music is. When you buy music, are you actually buying music? You download an MP3. Is that what you're downloading? Yeah, bits and electrons and stuff like that. Sure, you're downloading small movements of particles of iron due to a magnet. Sure, but even if you bought the CD or the piece of vinyl or the cassette tape or the 8-track tape or whatever, are you actually buying music? No. You're buying a recording of a performance. And given, you know, who's recording it and how it was done, you may be buying a compilation of 700 different recordings that are all punched in and punched out and all produced, right? That's not music. That's a record of something that was done. So is music then that sheet music that you would buy? Well, no, because literally those are just notes to the performer. Is music that instrument? No, because it's just an instrument, right? If someone untrained picks it up and starts to use it, they're not going to produce music. They'll produce sound, but they won't produce music. So is it then the performer that's music? No, that doesn't make any sense either. Because here's music. It only exists in the now. Music exists in the time where a performer performs and a listener listens. And you don't even need to have a listener to produce music. But it has to be, it's something that can only exist in now. It didn't exist in the past because you're creating it now. The performer is creating it now. The musician is creating it now. And it doesn't exist in the future either. Recordings of it could exist in the future, but that's not music. That's a recording. Pieces of paper that have notations for how the musician should play his or her instrument can exist in the future, but that's not music. Music is the most ephemeral of the arts, the most evanescent of the arts, because it has no past and no future. It only exists in the now. And that's going to be really, really important for our understanding of what goes on in that bar, in the Nagma bar with Hogwannis, when the narrator finally comes up to him and says, oh yeah, Zabalawi, sometimes he's here and sometimes he's not, but I am not even going to talk with you until you start knocking back a few drinks. And this drinking sequence is really interesting. It's on one level, it shows you how Mahfouz plays with the idea of, you know, in Islam, you don't drink alcohol like this, right? So this guy's not being a good Muslim, but what has that got to do with anything? It's, you know, you could be not, insert any denomination there, insert any religion there. If it is the right and good thing to do, you will do it, despite what that religion or denomination says. But if we pay really close attention to what happens when he drinks, we see the inevitable kind of result of that, right? So imagine a guy who's never had a drink in his life has to drink. Now he's going to drink 4 drinks in 15 minutes. Dude, that is pretty awesome, right? But that also means he's going to be pretty, pretty drunk, right? The first drink, right, he drinks it that well. The first drink, he tries to sip it, right? But then he drinks it quickly. Doesn't really tell you how he drinks it. The second drink, though, he knocks it back. He shoots it, right? Boom. The third drink, again, shooter. Fourth drink, again. And look what happens. The first drink seems to ignite, seems to catch fire. He's on fire. The second drink, he loses all willpower. The third drink, he loses his memory. And the fourth drink, he loses any sense of the future. Well, what's left then? Right? Only the past is gone because his memory's gone. The future's gone, as he says with the fourth drink. Any will or desire he has is gone. And for the first time in the story, he is, and this term is important, he is disponible. From the Spanish and Portuguese, it means to be available, means to live fully in the present, fully in the now. No baggage from the past, no concerns for the future, no worries or anxiety for the future, and no desire on your own part. Only then are you available or disponible for the mystical experience, for the direct, unmediated experience of the divine. And we see what happens here. He passes out. Well, sure, four drinks, first time drinking, I get it, passes out. He's in an immense garden surrounded by luxuriant trees, sees the stars. He's lying on a small hummock of jasmine petals. Things fall on him like rain, and the spray of a fountain comes, he feels on him, right? I was in a state of deep contentedness, of ecstatic serenity. There was an extraordinary sense of harmony between me and my inner self without discord, and between the two of us and the world, everything being in its rightful place without discord or distortion. In the whole world, there was no single reason for speech or movement, for the universe moved in a rapture of ecstasy. Wow. Now, we've talked about, if you look at that, if you look at the website, you see why it's difficult to describe the mystical experience, because you have to do it through analogy, because it is fundamentally ineffable, because it is direct and unmediated. But here, this is about the best analogy we're going to get for it. This guy's having the mystical experience. He is at one with the world. And of course, what do we find out what happens? While he's passed out, who shows up? Zabalawi. And why does he feel like he's laying on a pile of jasmine petals? Oh, because Zabalawi has jasmine petals around his neck. Why does he feel like he's getting hit with the spray of a fountain? Because Zabalawi is sprinkling water on him, right, to kind of wake him up. Why does he feel like the universe is working and everything functions and everything's perfect and these colored planes move and everything? This is the mystical experience. All is perfect, right? Of course, he wakes up hungover, and Hakwanis tells him, oh, dude, Zabalawi was here. And look what Zabalawi does to him, right? He sprinkles water on him. Can you think of a religious activity that uses water? There are two. The first is the invitation to the community, what Christians call baptism, right? And what that does is not only it welcomes you in, but it cleanses you. It purifies you. We call that an asperigial principle, right? It's purification, ritual purification here. This guy has it happen to him. Zabalawi invites him in, right? The strange thing is that, as Hagwana says, right, you can't tempt him or anything. You can't buy him or anything, right? But if he senses that you love him, he will do whatever he can for you. Amazing, right? If we want to describe a relationship with the divine, I think we'd do much worse than saying, if he senses that you love him, he will do anything for you, right? And so this becomes then, right? Now, there's this great fascination, and we could talk further about mysticism here. As he enters what's known as the dark night of the soul, that knowing once that you've had this kind of mountaintop experience, this great experience, you're constantly looking for it. And you're bereft when you don't have it. But you know that there's really nothing you can do except make yourself available to have it again. Because it is a gift. It's not something you earn. It's not something you perform certain rituals for or anything like that. It is a gift. And as he says, I must train myself to be patient. I've made certain that Zabalawi exists, so let me keep on looking for him, right? Suddenly, where's the meaning in his life now? The meaning is the search. This is so beautifully both religious and existential at the same time. The affirmation of the meaninglessness of your life is the first meaningful act you will ever do. That is, right, acknowledging that you need meaning and that you can either create or find or subscribe to some sense of meaning is a meaningful act, right? And that begins the journey. And for most of us, the mere fact that we're on the journey, as our narrator here is in Zabalawi, the mere fact that we are searching for meaning is the thing that gives our life meaning, right? Mahfouz is, I think, brilliant about this. And he serves as a lovely tonic, I think, after we've looked at existentialism, where we ask, you know, where is the divine when we look at somebody like Borowski? Where is the sense of morality and righteousness when we look at Marquez's story? I think Mahfouz is the perfect tonic to that, right? They're great Nobel Prize-winning authors who take religion seriously.